This is one of three breakout sessions for our weekend seminar, A Practical Theology for the Evening of Life. This particular session, A Christian Approach to Medical Technologies, was facilitated by myself, Sumner Abraham, an internal medicine physician and medical director of a hospice agency. And in the room, we also had a practicing cardiologist who's been practicing for decades, a geriatrician, and an internal medicine resident, and many members of the First Presbyterian Church in Jackson congregation. What's critical to understand at the outset before you listen to our discussion is that there is grace for any decision that one makes for themselves or for a family member, and that the church's role should be support of these individuals. Medical technologies are complicated, and it's hard to know what to do and how to make decisions in certain situations. And we talk about this in the session, but it's important to understand at the outset, if there is no decision made, the default for the medical system is to do everything. So with that brief introduction, I hope you enjoy our discussion on A Christian Approach to Medical Technologies.
Right. So what is cardiopulmonary resuscitation? It is a artificial way to have your heart beating so that blood can go to your brain and other vital organs. It involves chest compressions, meaning that people take their hands and push down on your chest several inches to manually squeeze your heart. It also involves, if you're going to do that, it involves putting a breathing tube down your throat. It involves putting in large IVs, needles, either drilled into your legs or placed into your arms as quickly as possible so that medicines can be rushed to your heart for it to squeeze better. It's a lot that's told in that, and I'm barely scratching the surface trying to speak in very lay terms in this. So when you're presented with this question of full code or do not resuscitate, most people say full code. Most people don't understand what that means, right? One of the most confusing points that people that I've encountered, and I'm sure that the other folks in here who have had this conversation a lot encounter, is I do not want to be put on a breathing machine, but I do want to be resuscitated. Okay? That is impossible. Okay? If somebody does not want to be put on a breathing machine, then they cannot be resuscitated. It's impossible. And so I think that we as the church even need to understand that simple distinction. You're going to check this box. Attempt resuscitation or do not attempt resuscitation. So in order to do that, that involves a breathing tube. Okay. The one particular nuance there is that whether you're a full code or a partial code or whatever that means, you can be on a ventilator but not be resuscitated. Right? If you need help just with being able to breathe. And so I think that kind of understanding with our family members what that actually looks like. Let's talk about breathing machines for a little bit. Ventilators, this was all the rage during the pandemic, right? We had car factories transition into ventilator manufacturers. The purpose of a ventilator is to provide oxygen to your body so that oxygen can be delivered to your lungs and therefore to the rest of your body. So it's more of an oxygen delivery mechanism than it is anything else. In order for somebody to be put on a ventilator, they have to be paralyzed and they have to be sedated. Sometimes that's, in the event of an extreme emergency, if somebody's heart has stopped beating and they have died, and they're not necessarily have to be paralyzed, but you get the point. There's a lot that goes into it. Breathing tubes cannot stay in people's airways for forever. There's only a certain amount of time before you have to think about another way, because it can the airway can start to deteriorate. And so we oftentimes you'll hear, and we can talk about this as much as y'all would like to, about kind of how to think through that. Okay. So CPR and kind of mechanical ventilation or ventilators. I think that kind of before we go further, as a Christian, I don't think there's anything wrong with either of those things. I don't think, I mean, the Bible clearly doesn't speak on it. I think that there are very devout, holy people that want absolutely none of that done, and there are some very devout and holy people that want all of it done. And I don't think that there should be guilt or shame in whatever you choose. I do think that you should understand the limitations of it. I don't know what the most recent numbers are. People whose heart stops beating outside of a hospital, their chance of actually living, like being alive afterward, is under 30%, if not worse than that. When it happens in the hospital, the chances of leaving the hospital alive are less than 10%. Okay. So it's, it is not as, it's such a pivotal question before people, you know, as you kind of come into the hospital, but the outcomes are not very good at all. And the trauma that occurs to the patient to enable that small percentage to be successful is profound. Okay. It's important to understand that the purpose of CPR is for somebody's heart to start beating spontaneously on its own again. There is a point in time between when the heart stops and when it is restarted where a questionable amount of oxygen is delivered to vital organs, namely the brain. And it is impossible to understand how much oxygen is being delivered to the brain or not. You'll hear this term anoxic brain injury. What that means is that once your heart stops beating and there is no oxygen going to your brain starts to die. And it is impossible to assess one's recovery until days, weeks after that CPR event. So you might ask yourself, well, as a Christian and I believe that I'm going to glory to meet God, then why in the world would I want to take that chance? And I think that's a very fair question that we can talk about. Right. There are certainly times and situations, though, where CPR, I was training with a young man who was my age. He and his wife came over for dinner 3 days before this happened, and they were talking about, they had just, they were Hindu, and they were talking about what they wanted their spouse to do if one of them were to die. And so my friend John was actually running on a treadmill on a day off of work, and he collapsed. Heart stopped beating. Now, thankfully, he lived in an apartment complex in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a physical therapist was also in there working out and did full CPR. And John was put into a medically induced coma in the cardiac ICU and actually recovered, right? Went back to work. He's a critical care doctor in Denver, Colorado now. John's story is the exception and not necessarily the rule, right? So I kind of use that illustration to say that CPR is a good thing. It can be a really a great rescue for people, but in the evening of life, most of the time it doesn't go very well. I think it's just important to name that. As you kind of go through the post-form, as we think about other medical interventions, there's kind of three different categories: full sustaining treatment, limited interventions, or comfort measures only. So let's talk a little about what that means. Full sustaining treatment is kind of full court press. Want it all done, no matter what it is. Medicines, ventilators, CPR. the whole nine yards. Limited interventions is really tricky. The Mississippi Post Forum reads this. I think it's also important to note that the hearings are going to be, so if you're listening to this, or for those of us that are here now, we should all go listen to the hearings talk about filling out the post forms and advance directives and the differences between those. Those are all state-driven. In your handout this weekend, for those of you that have it, underneath the recommended reading, there's a book by Bill Davis called Departing in Peace. If you were to Google Bill Davis, he, from a Christian biblical perspective, has filled out advanced directives and post forms from a Christian worldview for every state in America. It's a really helpful starting point for how do I engage these things as a Christian, and how might I think through them. He's done some really amazing work, and he has all kinds of resources for Sunday school classes who might be thinking through these advanced medical technologies. But as you get through the Mississippi post form, this is what limited intervention says. Transfer to the hospital if indicated. Avoid intensive care. Provide basic medical treatments. Provide intravenous medications, intravenous fluids. And then you have to be specific about vasopressors and dialysis and things like that. So it's a lot of medical jargon that I just said, and I'm trying to avoid any jargon. So one of the things that kind of starts to happen once we kind of get through CPR and ventilators is when we think about any other kind of rescue things. One thing that comes up is dialysis. Dialysis is kind of like an artificial kidney. It is a machine that is going to filter different byproducts from your body out that your kidneys typically would. So as we all get older, our kidneys get older. And I had a conversation this past week in clinic, a guy who goes to our church in Oxford. He's 96, and his kidney doctor has told him that he needs to go on dialysis. His question is, so what do I do about it? Dialysis requires 4 hours, 3 days a week. You go and you sit in a chair, and you have a tubing that's hooked up to you, and it pulls your blood out, filters it, and puts blood back in. So that's at least 12 hours of your week. People typically feel very tired and run down afterwards. Typically, people who are on dialysis start to lose weight. You can get infections from the vehicle by which your blood has to be filtered. And the life expectancy for people that are on dialysis typically is less than 5 years. If that long. I think 5 years is pretty generous. I think that's confounded by a bunch of younger people being on it. But that is one of the things on here. One of the other things to think through that I hear all the time with folks who are approaching the evening of life or caregivers is this idea of artificial nutrition and hydration. So let's talk about that for just a second. Parenteral nutrition is essentially taking artificially made proteins and nutrients and putting them into your bloodstream for you to be able to have enough nourishment for your body to function. You start to think about this when people are unable to eat weeks after they have kind of had a meal. Most of the time, people can get really terrible bloodstream infections from that because, again, you're taking a foreign object and putting it in your body and giving somebody nutrition. A lot of people feel a lot of guilt and shame about, is my loved one going to starve to death? Are they going to, and that's a very real concern that I don't... I think once you get to that point, there's something else that's going to take your life as opposed to starvation. But it's a very fair thing to think through. I'm not going to talk through much more of the post form just because of that. Any questions on, let's kind of just focus on some ventilator, CPR, dialysis questions. So kidneys, lungs, heart. Some of that may not have made any sense to you. That's okay if it didn't. Absolutely. And so for those that are listening, if you're unable to hear the question is more about how to think through medical technologies as it relates to time left. Like if I do this, I have this much time, or if I don't do this, I have this much time. I'd be curious to hear other medical professionals' opinions in here about this, so please do chime in. I always respond that that's an unfair question. Because it nobody really knows. And I again, like I said last night, I think that this comes back to how do you want to spend your time, not how much time do you have. There's this amazing study done a couple years ago that looked at people with metastatic cancer, pancreas, lung, and colon. Colon cancer, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer. The people that did nothing and went on hospice actually lived longer than people who got chemotherapy and aggressive measures. Months longer. And so I kind of bring that up not to because there is no crystal ball. And so most people don't understand all that the interventions entail. And so they think that if I do something, I just get more time. And it's just a trade-off. And the reality is that the medical system is compensated for doing stuff. Okay, that's the other kind of, I really don't want to be cynical, especially while being recorded, and that's not my intention at all, but the system is set up in such a way that you're paid for doing stuff. You're not paid if you don't do stuff, and that's part of the problem, is that I'm not compensated unless I do something, and so that's why there's this push to do more. We use the mic just so we can have it recorded.
As I heard that response, and you said people who live longer under hospice, I'm trying to understand what you mean by hospice. If somebody is going to select treatment, I mean, what is hospice care if you're not confined to a place or a bed or whatever?
Absolutely. This was an amazing experience. A couple weeks ago, I was talking to a patient about hospice, and they asked me if I was trying to kill them because they just didn't understand. They said, "Like, are you gonna stop giving me medicine? Like, are you trying to kill me?" That was their question, and I really appreciated their candor, and I think a lot of people have it. So, what is hospice? So we talked about kind of full court press. We talked about kind of some half court press. Hospice is what I would define as comfort measures only. The goal is to maximize comfort, is to treat symptoms. Instead of treating heart disease, I treat chest pain. Instead of treating lung disease, we treat shortness of breath. People go home on hospice and they live their They live their normal life. Hospice does not mean you're confined to a facility. Hospice is more of an ethos, an ethic, a way of caring that actually just transitions from I'm treating a bunch of diagnoses to I'm treating symptoms. For instance, I have a patient now who he was hospitalized 4 times in 3 weeks back in March. He's at home on hospice. He takes minimal medications, and he mows his grass on his riding lawnmower every day, and he's still alive.
That's what I was trying to
Yeah. And so hospice and palliative care, you know, a movement that really started in England, has come a long way and still has a really long way to go. And a lot of people don't understand what it is. But many people think that you're abandoning them. As we heard last night from the reading from Wendell Berry's short story, Fidelity, sometimes it's the opposite, where turning somebody over to the medical system is abandoning them. But with hospice, you can live your normal life, go to church. You don't go back to the hospital. And so if symptoms do arise, you stay at home, and we just make sure that whatever symptom you have has been fully treated. Can you turn the mic?
I noticed the difference in his, so I kept thinking, what are they giving him? I didn't know.
So
pain.
Question is, what are the medications that are given on hospice? So let's kind of rewind a little bit. We've understood that the ethos of hospice is I treatment still remains the same, but I'm treating symptoms instead of disease. Hospice is a Medicare benefit if you have a terminal diagnosis with the expectation to live less than 6 months. Now, that does not mean that you are kicked off hospice at 6 months in one day. It just means that the terminal diagnosis is such that you anticipate that the patient could die within the next 6 months. There is an interdisciplinary group of social workers, case managers, physicians, nurses, that has to recertify people on hospice every month just to make sure that people are not taking advantage of it because somebody has to pay for it. But it is a per diem, meaning a certain amount of payment per day to care for somebody on hospice. I bring up the fact that how it's paid for because it's important to bring up the question of medications and what medications does hospice pay for or what do they provide. Some people can be on hospice and still take an aspirin and a blood pressure medicine. Okay. Sometimes people go on hospice and everything's taken off, and that's kind of a discussion with the family and the hospice agency. The goal of hospice is to treat pain if they have pain. It's to treat shortness of breath if they have shortness of breath. It's to treat constipation if you're constipated. It's to treat bladder incontinence if you're incontinent. Whatever your symptom is, the goal is to treat it. Typically, if I'm misinterpreting your question, please tell me, some of the pain medications that are used are opiates and narcotics, and they can make people confused, potentially. It is very difficult to understand, though, at the end of life, if it is the medications that are making people confused or if it is the disease process that's making them confused. But the intent is to treat the pain, and there's lots of medications that can be used for that.
Are they supposed to tell you what they're using?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so this is kind of the other thing, too, is that no matter what the advanced medical technology that you're thinking about or having to think through, you should ask lots of questions And if you don't understand, I would empower you that you should understand to your contentment, not the physician's. Oftentimes, I think I'm doing a great job of explaining things, and I'm actually making the patient more confused by trying to explain it in what I think is a really eloquent and thoughtful way. You may be more confused about ventilators now than you were before we started. I don't know. Correct. No, from the hospice medical director. People that are at home on hospice, there is a physician that would oversee a group of patients that they are responsible for writing orders for, not necessarily physically seeing. Good questions. I'd love to hear Daniel, Miles. What's been y'all's, Dr. Fike, y'all's kind of experience on ventilators as Christians talking to people about ventilators? As a Christian, you can say I want everything done, or you can say I want nothing done, and you're not right or wrong. Daniel, how do you talk to your geriatric patients about, thinking through ventilators, CPR?
I think something that's often highlighted in this kind of tension is the fact that context is key. In general, physicians are going to speak about mechanical ventilation, prolonging life on a ventilator, in terms of a bridge to a certain goal. The question then becomes, what is that goal? Hopefully that goal is we have a short-term problem, a patient who cannot breathe, that we anticipate with support should be able to regain that function of spontaneous breathing and normal bodily, functions with sufficient support. That's a different context for someone who maybe collapses suddenly at the age of 45, with a heart attack, who needs that support until they get their heart vessels open and, they're in the ICU. And we anticipate with medical support that they will probably, we certainly hope with our interventions, come through that. That's a very reasonable situation in which someone says, yes, please do everything. If you have metastatic lung cancer or COPD, emphysema in its end stages, you know, putting you on a ventilator will really just prolong the inevitable and potentially cause more harm than good. Most people, when we talk about that conversation, when is enough, it's because everyone inherently understands that there's a certain amount of discomfort one is willing to endure themselves or perhaps watch a loved one endure with the hope of gaining a certain benefit. It's risk benefit. In the context where someone's process is irreversible, terminal, or otherwise so dire that we would not anticipate that the intervention would ultimately benefit them in the long term, I think that's whenever you have a family member in the ICU and the doctor saying, you know, this is it. Maybe they're already on a ventilator and we have to make tough choices about how long do we go? How far do we push? And those are difficult conversations, and those are really based off of the physicians. Oftentimes are relying on families to say, what is your loved one's values? So a lot of times I feel like it's, you know, the medical professionals or maybe families feel medical professionals put all of a sudden this huge burden of decision-making on them, and yet the family is looking at the doctor and saying, you know, you're the guy who's supposed to know, or the guy who's supposed to know kind of what's going on, what do you think we should do? And there's a lot of wisdom that a good and well-trained physician can bring to that conversation, but the physician's looking at you as the patient and as the family to say, what are the guiding lights and values that this person held, that your father, mother spoke of their faith and comfort and solace in Christ and the hereafter. Those are very, very helpful. So in those cases, context really is key in trying to understand what box to check, right? And I think that's sometimes another difficult paradigm to wrap your mind around, is that this form, the post form, is really a physician order. You know, you fill it out with your doctor based off of your values and goals of care, but it's the doctor that kind of signs off and says, you know, this is what we want done. If the ambulance arrives to your house and you have this form, then they have a physician directive to say how then they should interact with that patient and family. Otherwise, in the absence of that, they go ahead and provide the standard of care that they know, whether that be CPR or anything else. So the tough thing is, well, how do I know what's going to happen in the next week, the next month? Context can change. So I think there are a lot of good things about this weekend where we're trying to provide some coloring in of what some of these boxes actually mean in practicality played out, but with the understanding that some of these, you're allowed to change boxes, you know? There's no finality necessarily to a single form that says this is what I've decided and this is how it's going to be, you know, regardless of the circumstance. So when it comes to especially things such as rudimentary of CPR, supporting basic life functions, context can really help inform whether you want to continue it and adhere with the boxes you checked on the pulse form, or if the circumstances, medical or otherwise, would say we think it's reasonable to push through and actually do some of these more invasive measures. So you catch us kind of doing a lot of hand waving and kind of trying to hopefully provide families with the information about what we think medically is going on, what we think are the reasonable options, alternatives, risks, benefits, and then relying on family members and patients themselves as they're able to tell us, not necessarily to dump the decision on them, but to say, what are the things that you hold dear? What's a good day for you? What are the things you're willing to fight for and endure a certain amount of discomfort? And those things become, I think, a great solace to family members who have heard those statements from their love, you know, their family, their parents. It takes a great burden and a lot of guilt and shame away to be able to have those conversations. I think that's why we're here, is to have those conversations early, hopefully, and be a little more educated about how to have those conversations.
Yeah, and we kind of talked a little bit last night about how do you honor and dignify somebody in the evening of life, is you understand their story and Daniel, Dr. Hester's point is a good one, right? I mean, all these advanced technologies have got to be a bridge to allowing somebody to continue to live into that narrative, I think, right? Because your identity as a Christian is not going to change no matter what, but your life can look profoundly different. I think it's also important to state, too, the default for the medical system is to do everything. If you do not advocate for yourself or for your family, everything will be done, no matter what your view of the afterlife is. The most aggressive, the most dehumanizing will happen. You may also feel like that it's unfair. How am I didn't go to medical school. How should I know if I need dialysis or not? A quick word on bioethics, right? This principle of patient autonomy is king right now. That is in resistance to this historical medical Hippocratic tradition that it was deemed to be paternalistic, that the doctor is God and the doctor is going to tell me what to do or not to do. That there's a lot of resistance to that now, even though we do elevate physicians to a certain pedestal and look to them for advice. The bioethicist, as some have deemed them, the stranger at the bedside, have started to say that the patient should decide. I think what you're saying and why you're even listening to this is, how am I supposed to know? I don't know. I have no idea what any of this stuff even means. So how in the world am I supposed to decide what to do? But the default of the medical system is to do everything. In your experience, I mean, can you share a little bit about kind of?
Yeah, for 37 years of doing this, I can probably yell loud enough because I'm deaf and I don't hear people talk loudly for you. I think in medical care is incredibly complex technically, and if you are not careful, if I walk you to ICU or CCU at Baptist and let you look in one of those rooms at what's going on in there and then tell you, pick among this what you want us to do or not, I think to put you in that position is abominable. Think about what your goals are, and perhaps not the way to actually facilitate those. That ought to be left to a conversation with the physician. But think about what your goals are for you, for your family. And then the lady that said, I want a miracle, and I say, I believe in miracles too, but please don't ask me to provide them because I'm not here to do that. Think about your goals and then work out the mechanics. If you were designing a house, you'd go to an architect and you'd tell them what you want and so on. But if you get involved in going in there and telling the electrician how to wire your box in there, you're probably going to get yourself in trouble unless you know a lot about what he's doing. So for me to be told by the patient, I want you to do this and I want you to use this kind of stick. Somebody asked them, do you want to be put on the ventilator? And they said, no. Well, they didn't understand what they were saying. They didn't realize they were saying that if I fibrillate up here on the floor, nobody's going to do anything. But that's what they checked. And so know what you're answering when you go in the hospital. It's not always clear. And today the requirement is if somebody down here in admissions checked the box for you, that's abominable. That's not explained, but it's not. So know what you're answering. And again, as Sumner said, you need to ask questions and be sure you understand what you're signing yourself up for. It, to me, has frightened the daylights out of me that I've had people that are healthy and they have heart disease and they come in and that box gets checked. But it will, because that's the way you're at. You want to be put on a breathing machine or not? Oh, I don't want that. What they really mean is they don't want to be in ICU and lie there for 2 weeks with no chance of getting better, sustained. But that's not what they're checking. They're saying, if something happened to me, I'm not going to be treated for it.
Right. Question here.
My question is, Earl, if you're that person's doctor, why don't they ask you that question? If you know, you understand what I'm saying?
What do you mean?
What it means?
If one of your patients goes in, then why are they the ones that have to answer the question if you're medically able, by just what you described, to say don't do that? You understand what I'm saying? Why is this separation? I know you don't want to be called every 5 minutes, but you don't have that.
No, but what's happened is that the question was never asked in the past. And so now there's a requirement that it be asked, but it's going to be asked by somebody who's filling in boxes on the computer as to whether or not you want to be resuscitated. And it's complicated.
It's really complicated. Yeah, so
the box gets checked.
Right. Right. And so I think that what we're wrestling with here is there's lots of really fascinating medical technologies that in a certain time, in a particular circumstance, are helpful. We got a lot of homework to do. And as being a Christian and thinking through this, we have even more homework to do because it may be a little bit contrary to what is expected of us to think through, right? But to be crystal clear, when somebody asks you what your code status is, that question is talking about a moment in time. The moment when your heart stops beating, what do you want them to do? Code status is not an advanced directive. Code status is not a living will. Code status is not a medical power of attorney. Code status is not if you want to become a vegetable that people say all the time. Do everything you can, but I don't want to become a vegetable. It's like, we're not talking about that. When your heart stops beating, what do you want them to do?
So that's when you have the two choices.
Full code or do not resuscitate. Right?
There are ways to fine-tune that, though.
Sure.
I mean, we have what are called limited codes. And what I'd like someone to say, if you fibrillate, unless we're talking about the heart stopping, but actually a lot of these things are the heart going away too fast, to shock someone back in the hospital really is, I mean, that's recognized right away. They're on a monitor. You do it. There's no brain damage. That's fine. And so we may do that, but that person may also say, but I they're 82 years old and they've got a lot of problems. I really don't want CPR and on a ventilator because we feel like together that they'll never come off the bed. But it would make sense maybe to treat the arrhythmia. Pardon?
Like how do they make that choice if you're saying it's just two boxes?
So for those that are listening, there's kind of some discourse about when a heart goes into an abnormal rhythm and maybe doesn't necessarily stop. If a heart goes into an abnormal rhythm, a patient is still talking, they're still able to communicate, they might feel unwell. And the question becomes, do you provide electricity to make the heart return to a somewhat normal rhythm? And how do you decide if that is appropriate or acceptable in your light if I have to choose between do nothing or do everything, right? And there's a huge movement now to where there's all different nuance that can be applied to your code status. And I think it depends on what your pre-existing health conditions, which your comorbidities might be. Right. So this is coming from the cardiologist perspective, right? And I think that the oncologist or the cancer doctor perspective would probably have some other things to say, and the kidney doctor's perspective, you know, may. So some of it has to do with the lens through which you're looking at the facet of the diamond.
Just one other quick comment. Those decisions that are made in terms of intubation, ventilation, and so on, they're not irreversible. Sometimes say, you know, I'm not sure what direction this is going to go, but let's support your dad for a few days with a ventilator and see how he does. And when it becomes clear that he's not going to get better, and sometimes with an arrest like this, now, I mean, I have lots of stories after 37 years, but there are people that have come in literally comatose after a cardiac arrest, but it takes 48 to 72 hours before you know whether the brain is irreversibly damaged or not. So it makes perfect sense to support that person for that period of time on the ventilator to see if they're going to get better. But then if they don't, then you can reverse that decision. But that takes a lot of discussion and hopefully care by us, you know, to talk with you and to sit down with you and work through that with the family. But those decisions are not irreversible, and that's something important to know.
Right. So not only are the decisions not irreversible, I think that this is an amazing opportunity for your question is, how do I know if I'm even in that situation? That I even know that I need to understand that there could be nuance to it? I think that this is where the church could really do a world of good. This is like a dream, okay? COVID has changed who's allowed to come into the hospital, right? And who knows what that will look like in the future. And I think this is going to become an even more pressing, discussion, I think. Because you may not be able to call Dr. Fike. I'm not allowed to go in and take care of my patients right now in the hospital because of COVID. I can't go in and have, so I'll give you an example. An 86-year-old woman, I had just met her. She had just moved from New Orleans. She was moving from New Orleans to Oxford. She had a stroke. She couldn't move her left leg, and her left arm was very weak. She got COVID. Her son calls me. We're on the way to the hospital. I don't know if mom needs to be ventilated. Can you come up here and talk to us about it? They wouldn't let me in. So we went and stood in the parking lot and talked about it. I couldn't do it, right? But not only, and you know what was wild, is the son couldn't go in. And so who knows what the ramifications of the pandemic are going to have for accessibility into the hospital. We don't know what that's going to look like yet. Even people that are dying in the ICU alone, their families could not go in there. And you know, it'll be fascinating to see what that actually looks like. But I think that the role for the church is this, is that there could be ways for elders and deacons and other women who are in leadership in the church to understand this, to be able to love on caregivers and help them walk through that. There's lots of medical nuance here, but it's not anything that people can't learn and appreciate. You do not have to go to medical school to understand the limitations of these technologies. You don't have to understand how a ventilator works and how to change the settings on it. You just need to know, hey, day 8 on the ventilator and mom's not doing any better. There's no guilt or shame in saying we're done. And I think the church can fill that gap, because there's a profound gap between somebody that you've known for 20 years and you would be able to answer on their behalf and they would trust you to do so, but you don't have that opportunity because either you don't know they're in the hospital or you're not allowed to be involved in the care or you can't even go visit the family. But the church can fill into that gap. We have a couple of questions.
From a pandemic perspective, and what that's changing in the looks of patient care and why it's so important to have conversations with your family before they're in the situation, is so many times when I was in the ICU in March when COVID was really kicking off in Mississippi. Families were not allowed in at all. And we had people still in the ICU for things other than COVID. They're hooked up to a ventilator. They're hooked up to artificial kidney machines that are just continually cleaning their blood. And families can't come see them. They don't know what it looks like. We try to call them every day, explain what's going on. And this whole idea of, well, committing them to the hospital is a form of abandonment in a way, takes it to a whole nother level because they can't see it. They don't know what's going on. We try our best to explain over the phone what's happening. And they're just still like, oh, yeah, they want everything. They want everything. They want everything. And then it gets to that point where it's like, okay, we're at the end. We can allow you to come in and see them at, you know, sunset. You know, it is midnight. And they get in there and they're like, has it been like this for this long? And it's like, yeah, it's been like this for weeks, you know, sometimes months. And it's makes it very, very difficult. So knowing what's going on, what's happening, having the conversation, knowing expectations is super important. And I think the best way to honor that loved one in that situation.
Right.
So, and I would also encourage the talking about it, not just saying, oh, I filled this piece of paper out and it being there. Because if I called my parents and I said, like, hey, do you have a living will? Do you have an advance directive? And they're like, yeah, I already did that. I got that. I have no idea where to find it. I have no idea what it says. Talk to them. Figure it out.
Right. Right.
But yet, I don't really want either because I'm looking at the limited code. So in that case, I would say full code. Is that correct?
Well, right. So,
I mean, if she's saying which box.
Sure. And sure. There is space for you to tell them what you want. You are the boss, and the system should work for you. And if somebody tells you that's not acceptable, they need to change, not you, right? Now, there may be some where I was practicing before moving to Oxford, we had a choice. You could be DNRA, DNRB, DNRC. And trying to explain that to patients was, and that was like a health system legal department thing that was a disaster. But they were trying to account for this nuance in a regimented way of check one of these four boxes, and it became even more complicated. Where it really, you've got to have the conversation.
But you can always change.
You can always change. You can always change. And I think that's what's really important. Sure. The doctor and the nurse should review it with you, and you can make that request or a polite demand that it's reviewed with whoever the attending of record or physician of record is. But one of the things that I think is important to realize, we started this with the illustration, if I'm taking my mom to the hospital, okay? The only thing I'm focused on is getting well. And if you don't have the conversation before you get there, it's like Tim Keller saying in his article in The Atlantic, this psychological anxiety and fear that develops, even though you intuitively know you don't want this stuff done. But you're presented in this situation, and I think it is very easy to say, well, I didn't want any of this done, but I'm going to change my mind now, do it all, because I've got, you know, my grandchild's graduating from high school next week. I'm not missing it. That's real. That happens. And there's grace and space for that. But we've got to start talking about it. What I tell all of my patients is, if you're talking about it when you're in the emergency department, it's too late. It's too late. Because it's too complicated. There's too many permutations, there's too much unknown, and you need to talk about it before that point in time.
Ken, I'm responding to the issue that was just raised about COVID not being able to go see what's going on in the ICU. Mm-hmm. Can the family say, well, take a video, let me see what, can you do that? Or is there a legal liability from the hospital that they can't give you a video?
So that's a really interesting question, because the way that telehealth has changed, there's a lot of provisions that have allowed for people to even bill for medical services via a FaceTime or a video conferencing. I would say that most people would let you do it. I don't know the medical legal of it, and this is being recorded, and so maybe some other people do know, but I as a physician would have no problem doing it. I may get in trouble, but.
I don't know from a legal aspect at UMC. I don't know what the administration would tell me as far as do this, don't do this. I would not take a video of the patient, you know, filming, being like, this is the artificial kidney, this is the ventilator, here's the patient, here's the medicines, and then text that video to you. I wouldn't do that. But I would go on a secure platform and start a video chat with you and say, hey, how are you doing? We're going to go into the room. I'm going to show you, you know, how your father's doing. Okay, you know, here's your dad.
Some of it has to do with they wouldn't be able to do that if there was not explicit permission for you to be that person. That could be potentially the legal hiccup, right? To where if you're not on the patient's chart as somebody who could be their beneficiary or answer questions or learn about their care. And so that's another thing too, is that who actually has access to your information? Typically it's a spouse or an adult child or a dear friend at the church, right? You can put other people on there, you know? But you just have to kind of understand that there are, you have control over who can access your information or call on your behalf. And what a beautiful vision it would be to have your preacher on that list, right? They got a lot of stuff on their plate, but man, I mean, like, or your elder. Now that's a cool vision, to have a church where the elder is able to learn medical information on the behalf and help guide the family through it. But we've got to train people up. We've got to have nuanced conversations like this and feel the permission to say, I don't understand one thing you just said, and you're going to have to explain it to me again. Right? We've got to create the space in the church to be able to do that, or we're not going to make much progress, I don't think. These are really good questions. What else? Absolutely. It is very easy for people, fragmentation of medical care is increasingly difficult for everyone, especially now that everything is on, care is so complex, and it is the cancer doctor and the kidney doctor and the heart doctor and the internist and the geriatrician and the allergist and the all these people that you're going to see and how you coordinate it, you've got to find somebody that you trust. And I think this goes back to you've got to pick a doctor that is willing to take that on and that you trust his or her worldview to help them guide you. I don't think it has to be. And this is not a come see me infomercial. This is a find somebody that you trust. I think some people would say, my Christian oncologist is who I really want to kind of be the quarterback here. And, you know, some of the, if there's a Christian oncologist listening to this, they're probably like, please don't record this and say that you're signing me up for that. But I do think that people are willing to help you think through that and navigate all the different avenues that you have to do. It is really difficult, right? I see patients all the time who are going from specialist to specialist, and they're lugging around their Walmart bag of medicines, and they are overwhelmed. They have 6 appointments in a week, and they're doing everything they can just to get there on time, much less understand what's going on. So the question is, how do we find healthcare providers that are Christians and maybe see things the same way that we do, that we can trust, that hope to be with us in the evening of life? And how do we make that transition? I think that this is another way that the church can be very practical and very helpful, right? Is I think that there's got to, I mean, like the church needs to know who his or her parishioners are that are seeing people and that are willing to take on folks. There is a push. There's a guy named Farr Curlin. That's a name that if you like reading about this stuff, you should know. Farr is a, he actually started the Christian medicine and theology program at Duke. It's an amazing program, and he started the Conference for Medicine and Religion, CMR. So there's a CMR network of people. I'm involved with them, and so are many others throughout the country. There is a push amongst some people to have some way to distinguish a Christian physician, not like a certificate or a credential, but a way to Google it, for lack of a better term. So there is a push for something like that to start happening, but it's not ready for prime time yet.
This is your forum. I gave Sumner a book last night that I got from the hospice program over at Baptist. If you're interested in trying to, as a layman, to think through some of these interventions like hydration and dialysis and code, there's a book by a guy named Hank Dunn. You can buy it on Amazon. It's called Hard Choices for Loving People. And he's a chaplain. He goes through all of these things in lay terms. And it's very good to understand a little bit about what the results of CPR are. For example, if you're an elderly person in a nursing home, the chance of surviving if you have CPR done is, I mean, it's way down in the less than 20% range. It's very helpful, I think, to understand these things from a layman's perspective. What are your goals and what are your expectations? If they are that, you know, that we're going to work a miracle for you, and you're looking in the wrong place.
Yeah, do not come to me for a miracle. So Hard Choices for Loving People by Hank Dunn is a book that was just referenced. And then Bill Davis, if you Google Bill Davis Christian End of Life Care, he's got some amazing resources for churches to think through this stuff. I want to be respectful of everybody's time. Have time for maybe one more question, and then we'll pray and go in peace, as they say. So we're good. Let's pray real quick. God, we thank you that you're with us at all times. God, we thank you that you're with us as we go out today. God, we thank you that you're with us when we sleep. God, you're with us when we go to the doctor. You're with us when we care for loved ones. You're with us as we make hard decisions. God, your word tells us that you hem us in from behind and before. So God, go before us for the rest of our days. Help us to learn what it might look like to number them and to live with a joy that was set before Jesus, so much so that he endured the cross and endured its shame. God, that work of Jesus makes us able to have these conversations and gives us the confidence that this world is not our home, but we're promised an eternity where death doesn't exist. No sickness, no tears, no sadness. Help that vision grant us the grace to live even this afternoon. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you all.